Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's the day after the Dutch Grand Prix, and it is an absolute pleasure to have you along with us as ever to talk all things Assen with Keith Ewan, Pete McLaren and myself, Harry Benjamin. The summer 5-week break has officially begun and we've been delivered a bombshell straight away. So naturally, that's what we're going to talk about first. After topping nearly pretty much all the sessions, bar the most important one, where Fabio Quartararo did take the win in Sunday's race, it's his teammate, Maverick Vinales, making all the headlines, second in the race. But it has just been announced that he is requested to end his Yamaha contract early, and by mutual consent, they are going to part ways at the end of the season. Keith, this is massive. What does this mean? Is it confirmation he's going to Aprilia? Who's replacing him? So many questions.
There really are, and there are not that many answers when it comes to why he would have done what he did. If you remember, let's wind back to the Suzuki situation. He felt really at home at Suzuki. It was like a family for him, and he felt very comfortable there, and it was a real big wrench to make the correct decision to go to Yamaha. I say correct because it was correct. Yamaha was, and still is, one of the best bikes. I'm nearly choking myself on this because I can't believe it myself. It's a WTF moment, isn't it, really? It's kind of like... I can't believe what I've just, you know, lots of rumours, lots of talk about it and the like, but how did it actually get to that? Obviously, internally, there's a problem with the Yamaha management and Vinales. He doesn't feel like he's getting anywhere. To put it in some kind of context, Valentino Rossi is suffering from a similar problem on the bike. The grip levels that he's getting from the acceleration grip levels that they're getting is not really suiting their riding style. You know, Quartararo is riding around it. Some would say, well, they get paid the big bucks, so they've got to be able to ride around these problems when they come. And Quartararo is obviously doing that. The way he sets his bike up looks different to most other people anyway as well. So he's getting around it. But the retirement, the throw the towel in situation with Yamaha, we've seen it before, but never quite as dramatic as this one, I don't think. I think this one is where's he going to go? Aprilia. Do they have a great record for pastoral care? Absolutely not. Look at Scott Redding. Look at Bradley Smith. What they basically dumped on both of them at the same time. They're a team that's quite harsh on anybody that's not actually performing 100% or in the way that they want them to perform. So I think it's a very risky move to dump the millions of dollars he'd have been on at Yamaha and on the best bike on the track to go to Aprilia, which is not yet. Yeah, it's not a top five finisher yet, is it? I mean, at the end of the day, even with Aleix Espargaró biting the screen, it's still nowhere near there. And Dovi, you know, I have the feeling that Dovi probably would have raced it this year had it been a bit closer than what it is. And yet that deal's not been done. Well, I suppose we're feeling a bit sorry for Maverick Vinales, but spare a thought for Dovi because he's just dropped down the pecking order. His stock value's just fallen through the floor, hasn't it, now that you've got Vinales, who's current and younger, available to sign for free virtually. I can't make out, Harry or Peter, why you would leave Yamaha other than in the terms of a proper divorce, irreconcilable differences, it has to be done in that circumstance. I don't think there's a winner. I don't think in this at all. I think that neither party would have wanted to have done it. It's obviously something that they've released him from his contract, as they would. It said in the British press release that he'd asked to be released. It didn't say that in the Japanese press release we noted this morning from one of our colleagues in Japan. That part of it was left out. Whether that's for face in Japan, I don't know. But that's a point actually worth mentioning, isn't it, Peter? How much the Japanese, as a race, hate criticism publicly. It's don't wash your laundry in public in Japan. That's a fact. The teams hate a situation like we had a couple of weeks ago where Maverick was giving them a fairly hard time publicly over the bike. That will not have gone down well.
Exactly, Keith. Yeah, and let's not forget, only, 18 months ago, when the contract picks, if you like, were being made for the 2021 season, Maverick was the first one to sign. You know, at the time when he signed, which was January 2020, all of the top seats were available, and Yamaha made him their priority, which was a big boost of confidence. You know, for Maverick, it was a big vote in, you know, you are going to be our future guy. And yet here we are, and Maverick's saying, I want to leave. And as Keith said, it's a big blow for any team to have that, to sever a contract and a very well-paid contract. Again, January 2020, that's before the coronavirus. So he was one of the few that signed on the old terms, if you like. So
can you imagine what's going on in the paddock at the moment? It's the best exercise rider management have ever had this year, because they'll be running down that paddock backwards and forwards, face masks on, trying to get in there and get this deal done, because you've got all sorts of things going on now. It's losing it. Yeah, with the possibility, and I think a very distinct possibility, that Valentino Rossi will call it a day in the next few weeks as well. So you've got two factory Yamaha men from last year that aren't even going to be on the bloody calendar maybe for next year at the moment. And all of a sudden, Morbidelli, he should definitely be shifted up into a factory bike, whatever happens. Franco Morbidelli, when he comes back from that knee injury, quite rightly, actually, his timing is quite good because he's kept himself out of this bun fight, hasn't he? He's getting that knee that's been playing him up a little bit over the last few months. He's getting that knee fixed. And by the time he comes back at the end of this long layoff, the longest layoff we've had in ages for the summer break, he should be on top form by the time he comes back, maybe half a year on a factory bike. I wonder if they can actually move Maverick across to Petronas, to the SRT team, and put him on a 2-year-old bike. I wonder what's in his contract. He wouldn't surely agree to it, so it would have to be in his contract that they can place him in any team they want to place him in.
I think you have to use the same the engine rules, isn't it? So I think it'd be like a technicality where they could move him, but I think he would have to keep with the same engine and bike. Yeah. So yeah, but as you say, difficult one. I mean, let's remember when this last happened with Johann Zarco. You've mentioned it before, Keith. You know they decided, look, this is too difficult to try and keep a rider that wants to leave for the rest of a season. And they decided, look, it's better if you just leave, because if you don't want to ride for us in a year's time, why ride for us now?
Contracts are basically financial issues and the nuts and bolts. If a team or a rider are not happy with what they're doing or where they are or who they're with, you might as well let it go. It is literally irreconcilable differences. You know, you've got to tidy up the financials and divvy up the 50% here and there, and off you go. But I cannot believe that Maverick Vinales management will have not had Plan B up their sleeve. Where is Plan B? What could possibly be in the paddock at the end of this 2-year period? I mean, everyone's up fairly soon for contract anyway. I wonder what else he's got up his sleeve. You surely wouldn't leave yourself exposed to just Aprilia.
What about a year out?
There must be...
No.
Nobody does that. I mean, nobody apart from Dovi who expects to do that at the moment. I mean, a year out with the pace of today and the way things are going, everything changes in a year. You know, look at Marc Marquez. He's been out for 580 days or whatever it was since his last win. And it's been a real struggle for him to get back to it. A lot of people thought he'd be back on it. Sachsenring he was, but of course this weekend, not so. And that's the kind of struggle you have if you take too much time off. Motivation, all the things that are going on in your head, it's in here. Everyone, all these guys are top line riders, but it's all up north of the eyebrows to make it work out on the racetrack. But it's all so tight, all so close. I had a long conversation just before we came on air with John Cooper, the wonderful JC, regarding penalties and stuff like that. He rang me because he's incensed by penalties. He's old school like me, and he's incensed by penalties. I'm sure we'll go there in a minute, so I'll bring up some of the comments that John had to say about it. All of them, you know, wonderful. But I can't see how he can have a year off. why would anybody risk in today's marketplace, why would anybody risk the inconsistency of Maverick Viñales in a year's time? It's almost bad enough to risk the inconsistency of Maverick Viñales now, even though we know he can win races given the right set of circumstances. You know, from a team management point of view, you look at the youngsters that are hovering there at the moment. They're, you know, Fernandez, you've got so many that are just waiting to go. And it's really just a case of how much a factory team is prepared to pay for someone to break their other factory contract they're already on. That's what it is going to amount to nowadays, is that there's a logjam of really good talent, but it's going to be down to whether a factory is prepared to pay another factory to break that contract, to get that talent. Something's got to move soon.
As you say, Keith, the only seats that we know are available, there's the Aprilia one, obviously, which seems the overwhelming favourite. There's the VR46 Ducati seat. Maybe interesting, Ducati, they made a big bid for Viñales, but VR46, they always have Italian riders, so, you know, who knows. But, and then apart from that, it's the Tectoire KTM, which is, as we've discussed, is overflowing with options. So really, I mean, you do wonder, if you're Viñales, maybe do you just wait a month and just see if anyone goes, oh, hang on a minute, we've got a clause with our rider, and he's not quite as far as he should be up the channel, or something. You know, maybe he just waits to see what comes out of this. But if you're Aprilia, I think, you know, you've been messed around with riders enough for the past year or two. And Aleix was saying yesterday, it was interesting because Aleix, Viñales' teammate at Suzuki, you know, they got on very well. He didn't want to talk at all about Viñales. Now, that's because that was just another sign. It's one of those things where it's not what you say, it's what you don't say. That they must be really, really close and they don't want to mess it up, you know. But he was saying, look, I think a lot of these guys that turned down this ride, the Moto2 guys last year that didn't want to ride this bike, he says, I think they're going to regret it. You know, when you look at the bike now, it's, he said, I'm eighth in the championship, you know, and he's consistent with that bike. It's not a bad bike now. As we've said, it's not a world championship winning bike. It's the only bike that hasn't had a win in the past year, not had a podium. But it's far from a disaster bike now and it's made big steps. So who knows, but it looks
can I play a bit of devil's advocate on that one, Peter? I mean, at the end of the day, they've had concessions and we've been on a technology freeze. You know, when we get back for next year, we ain't on a technology freeze. They're going to be chucking the kitchen sink at it. And as the little factory at Aprilia, Noali, have they come up with something special for 2022? I wonder. I mean, I think it's a big gamble. I really do. If he's putting his eggs in the Aprilia basket, you know, next year, we're going to see a step. Everyone's going to be making a step of some sort or another next year, because we've been on a technology freeze because of the COVID. So I don't know whether Aprilia, it's a great little motorbike. I mean, it's there or thereabouts, isn't it, at the moment? Okay, it's not been higher than sixth place. I don't think it is at this moment in time. Aleix, he's a man that gives everything, but is he of the quality of Maverick Viñales? And this is what's going to be going around in people's heads, you know. Where is Aleix in that pecking order? You can't really tell, can you? Because you don't really know how good the Aprilia is or isn't. It's there or thereabouts. Aleix is on it. Now, if you'd had Iannone here still, if he hadn't been, you know, eating drug-laden steak or whatever it was that got him in trouble, then the fact is that we'd have a yardstick to measure that bike by, because however nutty you might consider Iannone to be, he could ride a bloody motorbike. There's no doubt about that. And he would have been brilliant. You can understand why Aprilia hung on for him. Because he was really their great hope. He was a world-class rider, given a few little sparkling sideshows that he was very good at. Aleix, where is he in that pecking order? See, I think Viñales is a more likely race winner on any motorbike than Aleix Espargaró. That's my personal opinion. You know, Aprilia must think that Christmas has all come at once if Maverick Viñales is prepared to come along and race it for them next year. But at the same time, what was that old Kevin Schwantz saying? Next year, he could come apart like a cheap watch. You just don't know. It's a risk, massive risk for both.
Hasn't Viñales and, you know, perhaps his stock has fallen down a little bit because, you know, of Quartararo's dominance so far this season. And you could see that you brought it up just a few minutes ago, Keith, about, you know, this is a mental game as much as anything. And you saw, you know, when they pulled up at the end of the race, that Vinales was just so, he just didn't look happy at all. And you could see literally the stark contrast between Quartararo celebrating with the team, and there's that brilliant shot of Vinales just drinking his water bottle and looking absolutely like just so bitter. So surely, do you think he kind of had to go, really, because he's being absolutely slaughtered by Quartararo?
Yeah, well, excuse me on that one. I mean, welcome to the big boys club.
Yeah.
This is MotoGP. These guys are getting paid millions of pounds. You know, you've got to get your motorbike sorted. Quartararo and his team on his side of the garage. Yeah, you know, Quartararo, I can't remember what turn it was now. There's a section of Assen. Year on year, the way he's got his bike set up, the thing's giving it a load of this all the way through the corner. I mean, he's tagged. He's not letting it off at all. But the thing's shaking its head. So the way he's got his bike set, it's sensitive in places. My point being is that you've got to either ride round or set up round, whatever the problem with the bike. There's not delivering your grip at the rear or not delivering your grip at the front. You've got to work that out with your crew chief, and you've got to do the best you can do with it. It's no good whinging about what you've got. And it's no good sometimes looking the other side of the garage. Otherwise, everybody that had been in a Repsol Honda camp would have thrown the towel in halfway through the year, because Marc Marquez does everything different to everyone else. So it's kind of a valid point, Harry, but not, in my view, as an ex-rider. You know, you're given a pile of poop and you've got to sort it out. You know, you've got to get it in a position where you can ride the thing properly, and you've got to get the best out of it and keep digging in. This is a gritty sport on and off track. And you know, I don't know. I kind of feel sorry for Vinales. He definitely has a head problem. There is no doubt in my mind he has a head problem. There, you know, all of his problems are, like I say, north of the eyebrows. That bike might not be perfect in a lot of places for him, and clearly for Valentino as well, bearing in mind they're in two different camps nowadays. But you've got to work around it. And Quartararo should be an inspiration rather than something to, you know, blow your brains on. You know, you look across the garage and think, grit, he can do it. He's doing it. What's he doing? How's it working? Why can't we go? Yeah, Vinales, he was the only man on the grid to go with a soft front tyre. Huh? Why would you do that? I mean, it's obviously because he likes the feel of it. But Alex Briggs, one of the most respected, you know, chiefs of the crew variety in the paddock, no longer back in Australia and enjoying himself in a retirement. But Alex Briggs commented, you know, if he thought he was going to be able to get away in front with a soft front tyre on, not being in a crowd, because obviously as soon as you're having to force it to fit everywhere, and you've got all that hot air around you coming off the bikes in front, your tyre starts to overheat and it blows up like a balloon. So you have a less of a contact patch, if you get me with that. You know, as soon as the tyre pressure increases, you've got a harder tyre and not the squidge that you need from a front or rear tyre. And they set the tyre pressure so that they expect it to go to a certain tyre pressure when it's at working temperature. But you've got different working temperatures when you're in a crowd or when you're out front. You know, if he set it up to be out front, then once he got stuck in a bit of a crowd early on, which Vinales tends to do because he's useless at starting, then he's got a problem. If he set it for being in a group, and then he goes out front and he's got all clean air in front of him, then he's got a problem there as well. The soft front tyre, for me, as soon as I saw that, I remember thinking, why is he doing that? If you're in any doubt at all, look along the road, put on what everyone else has got on, because generally it works. But to be the only man out of the whole grid that went for a soft front, I don't get what goes on in his head.
That was a huge talking point, wasn't it? Pete, did you get anything from him from, you know, the post-race press conferences? Because it looked like he sort of stood by that decision.
I mean, the whole press conference was bizarre, wasn't it? Because it started off with kind of a complete denial that he was going to leave Yamaha and go to Aprilia. And then what followed was about a million reasons why he might well leave Yamaha, wasn't it? So it just followed on from what you say, the scenes after the race of just looking completely dejected. And you got poor old Massimo Marigali, the team manager, trying to get him to join in. And it was just awkward, wasn't it? All we really understood from that pretty bizarre press conference was that, you know, Maverick the Saxon Ring thing, finishing last, was obviously a big issue. And the fact this didn't really leak out, you know, this whole move, this whole split came out all at once, shows you it happened really quickly. So it was just a quick decision, I think.
But his former management knew about it because he broke it, didn't he? I think he got broke on Twitter. It was one of his former aides, if you like, that got it out there. And it's someone that really, really was in the know. But I thought you mentioned the body language between the team and Maverick on the podium. Oh, awkward or what?
Well, it was awkward, wasn't it, Pete? It was a pain to watch. And then it was really random how he would just flat out denied the rumours. And then suddenly, was that just...
The ink wasn't dry, Harry. The ink wasn't dry.
it's all my guess in the day. Answer this then. One thing we do know is that Vinales is off. Jack Peterson has asked, if you were Yamaha, who is top of the shopping list? Oliveira maybe? Or would they try and poach someone like Acosta? Promote from within? What's your money on?
Well, mine's Morbidelli. I think I've said that already. Mm. I mean, I think Morbidelli would be the right shout morally and, you know, on track as well. I mean, he's due. But then again, you can go a bit left of field, can't you, with these things? And it comes back down to what I said a minute ago, Pete. Who's going to pay to break other people's contracts? Aprilia. Actually, significantly, Aprilia. Were you allowed to say that?
I was just going to say, Aprilia. You know, you mentioned previously the Petronas team sort of had to accept Rossi, you know, and it wasn't part of their plan. They didn't set up their team trying to sign Valentino Rossi. And it was, well, you've got Rossi now. I'm just wondering, you know, Morbidelli has a contract with Petronas for next year. If they now also lose their top guy to the factory team, it's just, you know, another one. I mean, like he's saying, it makes sense. You know, he's the obvious guy to go into that seat. But you're just thinking the Petronas team yet again have someone mess with their rider lineup. You know, something happens outside of their team that just ends up going, you know.
But doesn't it come back down as well to what I said weeks ago, that Yamaha always seem to be behind the ball? They're behind the game all the time. They're never quite on it, like KTM. They've got a whole train of youngsters coming through. You know, someone's going to have to pay them big money. What I was going to say before we got to that was that Aprilia denied that they were going to pay to break Yamaha's contract. They put it out there. I think Rivola, team manager, the old F1 guy that's in there now, the young F1 guy, I should say, that's in there now. It's just my language. He denied that they would pay to break Yamaha's contract. So right now they're going to get, you know, the $8 million man possibly for free. That's a deal of a decade for Aprilia if it works
out.
Head
of a signing. Yeah.
I was just going to, yeah. I mean, also, there's not just the factory seat, of course. There's the Valentino Rossi seat, which is, you know, I mean, he said himself it's looking very difficult for next year. So, and we should know more by the Austrian rounds after the summer break. So Yamaha need two riders, not just one. You know, they've got, obviously, Garrett Gerloff was having what you could see was maybe an audition this weekend. You hear rumours about Toprak, you know, the Turkish star.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's Raul Fernandez, you know, does this change everything? The fact that Yamaha, we've been saying, they've now got a whole load of money that they're saving for next year. Suddenly the fee to buy Raul Fernandez out of his contract, no problem. You know, €500,000, you know, they're going to save, what, $5 million at least. So does that change everything? I mean, there's a whole list of names, even Marco Bezzecchi, you know, maybe. But who?
Yeah, but in a perfect world, you would say that Raul Fernandez, yes, they should buy him out of his contract anyway because he's such a talent. And it is only 500,000 only. But it's a lot less than the likes of Maverick Vinales and co. But really, the natural place for someone like Raul to go, if you were running a ladder, would be through the SRT team, from the Sepang Racing team, through Petronas. It wouldn't be straight in a factory team. It shouldn't be by rights, because having only had 1 year in Moto2 and then suddenly you're stuck in a full factory Yamaha team, I think that's a step too far, personally. Especially when you've got a ladder team like Petronas that you could place him in. And the fit is really wonderful. I mean, that pastoral care that I was mentioning earlier that Maverick is obviously missing since Suzuki, you get that at Sepang Racing Team. Razlan Razali, Johan Stigerfeld, what a great team. Quite good at that. Although I know one young Scot that might be arguing with my point there. They haven't looked after him perhaps quite as well as they should. I'm talking John Maffei, of course, for anybody that is only just tuning into this podcast and doesn't listen to us often. But You know, John McPhee, obviously, he was stuffed last year when he should have had a Moto2 ride this year, and they kept Jake Dixon, so there wasn't one for him. And then this year, they've nicked his crew chief to move to Jake Dixon as well. So he either hates the team or hates Jake Dixon. I wonder why. McPhee wouldn't. He's a lovely, lovely man, and I know he'll take it professionally. But my point being, it's quite ruthless, isn't it, in MotoGP? I've kind of contradicted myself because I said pastorally.
they care for you, but they also don't.
But when needs must, out comes the saw.
It's sport. It's business, isn't it? Now, you mentioned Garrett Gerloff there, obviously making a debut in MotoGP, replacing Franco Morbidelli due to his knee surgery, the young American coming in. And it looked like a pretty decent run from him, actually, considering, you know, first time on the bike, first time handling wet conditions as well earlier on the weekend. Do you think he's realistically put himself in the frame for a seat while we're on the subject of Yamaha?
I'd say it was too early, personally. He had that go last year in Valencia, you know, in practice, and he really acquitted himself very well in difficult conditions. This weekend was a bit more of a wake-up call. I mean, the Cathedral of Speed, Assen, and all that goes with it, it's a massive step for Gerloff, but I think he acquitted himself pretty well. But I mean, you've got a couple of things here, haven't you? Dorna are keen to get an American back into it at the top level. They're keen to get a Brit back into it at top level. Cal Crutchlow, something else that I don't understand, you know, like they've got Cal Crutchlow as a test rider, but really with the amount of testing they can do, must be the best job Cal's ever had to get paid for sitting on his sofa talking about it. You'll really appreciate that playing with Willow instead of bloody out there grinding off the laps in some sweaty Italian racetrack. So Cal's, they need a Brit, they need an American. The Aussies are coming, you know, Remy's there, so they're getting the Australian market back on track as well. I mean, Dorna are doing all they can to make this work, but Toprak, I mean, what's the Turkish market like, I wonder, for motorcycles? Because it's a big country, 80-odd million people there. It must be a big market that's opening. And again, that's something that everybody considers when they're thinking about riders. Toprak, for me, Razgatlioglu, I love the bloke. I mean, I think that he's got personality, he's... You know, if you want to tick corporate boxes, he's of a different religion to most people. He's come from a part of the world that, you know Keenan Sofuoglu was outstanding back in the day, but that was in super sport. But to have a top Turk in MotoGP and one as, what's the word I'm looking for, with the flair that he's got and the personality that he's got, I think he'd be a real asset to MotoGP. But is the Turkish market the one that Dorna really want to be in? Or because this is the other influence that comes into it. It's not just the factory, it's the global marketplace.
Well, Phil Coombs actually said, Pete, he's asked, you know, why Garrett Gerloff and not Toprak? Surely Toprak is the most deserving Yamaha rider in the World Superbikes.
Well, this, of course, assumes that Toprak wasn't offered at first. We don't know. Now, it's certainly possible. You hear rumours that Toprak, he doesn't want to go in and risk everything on one race. You know, it's a hard thing to do, isn't it? When this is the one impression that you might make in the MotoGP paddock and you just dropped in, as Keith says, at Assen, you know, no testing, there you go. And then if you don't have a good weekend, he's not ready for it or whatever, you know. So I think that possibly we don't know what the order was. I mean, Cal officially is the Yamaha replacement rider. So clearly Yamaha wanted to put somebody different to Cal because they wanted to give someone a chance to potentially sign for next year. That's all we can deduce that much. And then you've got all the Yamaha Superbike riders really potentially could be on it.
Yeah, but there's a sugary drink department you've got to think about as well. Who's on Monster and who's on Red Bull? You know, these are things that also, who's wearing what cap? You know, you've got sort of side contracts that are quite lucrative that both team and rider. If you've got a conflict there, then there's immediate problems as well. You know, Cal has always been a monster man. Yamaha a monster. Watch out for that infiltrating Red Bull. It can be a snag that. I mean, there aren't that many rider managers in the paddock really, because you tend to find that one manager has got, you know, three, four, five riders that are signed to him. And they're all around the back of the buses, yeah, trying to do these deals behind the trucks. It's great sport to go and watch them in a paddock whenever we get back there again. I'd love to be there now, because you'd walk around a truck and there'd be like two of them nose to nose discussing the schedule of where they want their riders to go and what they think they're ready for and what the finances of it are and all the rest of it. I always used to feel a bit sorry for Roger Burnett, who obviously looks after Sam Lowes, because Roger Burnett, the former Grand Prix rider as well, but Roger only had Sam Lowes in the paddock, so he only had one man to really negotiate with, whereas all the others had like three or four that they could sort of place into the Jenga pile of talent. And it's great fun when you run around the corner, you're about to go and do your next job, and you run around the corner, and then there'll be two very serious managers stuck in the toilets or somewhere where they, you know, trying to beat the next deal out of each other. It's quite good fun.
It's a sport
watch.
In itself, it's a sport, isn't it? In itself. Yeah. let's move on though for a little bit to third place man, Joan Mir. Good run to third from 10th yet again from that row of the grid. He said he's really encouraging Suzuki though to work hard this summer, because they've still got to find some outright pace, particularly in qualifying, because he clearly got it in the races, but the qualifying is just setting him back, isn't it?
Come on, Keith.
Who wants to go first?
It kind of feels like we've been here with a Suzuki. Joan Mir, Alex Rins, who's got the most pace this year? It looks like Rins has, to be honest, with one way and another. But they're not quite there, are they? I'd like to know what they've got in the pipeline for next year. You know, next year is critical for Suzuki. I think this year really is not going to be their year, it would seem. And what can they do in the summer break? You know, there's not much.
Well, that's actually
really
my question. How much can be done? Because obviously, there's a full
you
shutdown.
You analyze everything. What you do is you go back over the ground you've gone over. It's a bit like it's a cold case file in a murder.
Oh God!
You're looking back over the evidence. You're trying to work out, you know, what have we missed here? Where can we find that tiny degree? And we're only talking tiny degrees. I mean, some bloke wrote to me with some angst earlier on today on Twitter that said, you know, like Valentino Rossi, he's still fast. He's only a second behind. He's, you know, he's not done with yet and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, mate, you've missed the boat. You know, a second nowadays is a tenth from before. You know, it's a second is like, forget
it. A lifetime.
It's no longer credible. You know, and then that's the problem you have now. And bringing it back to the Suzuki example is that they're looking for thousandths of a second. These are tiny, tiny improvements that they're looking to. Everyone's going to be looking. It ain't just Suzuki. You know, everyone's going to be doing exactly the same thing, poring over the data and trying to work out where they might find something extra.
If there's one thing that, if you look at what does the Suzuki need, it's that rear ride height device, isn't it? I mean, that's the, if you were to try and, because like he says, you know, everything else is data set of everything else. But if you just look at the bikes, compare it to the other bikes, what has it not got? It hasn't got this rear ride height device. So that's got to be something that they're working on. You know, the riders are pushing for it. Maybe it'll be ready in Austria, who knows? But outside of that, it's just details and details and details, as Keith's saying.
I think that ride height device, I think we're going to see that when he comes back. I mean, that's probably the only thing that's a big chunk that they can grab something. I mean, you know, tracks where you've got to make the start, where you've got to be on the front two rows of the grid, you can't lose that qualifying position. Not that they qualify that well anyway, actually. That, you know, the ride height thing will give them a hand off the line. But first of all, you've got to get it on the front two rows of the grid, which seems to be a bit of a problem for Mir in particular. So they've got a bit of work to do. But the riders as well. Yeah. This is going to make you smile slightly. I was giving my daughter a driving lesson last night, and I tried to make the analogy to a Grand Prix team. I don't know how the hell or why I was even thinking it. It never stops in my head. And I was saying to her, look, it's no good going out for 2 or 3 hours and doing the same stuff, because you'll make the same mistakes. What you need to do is have an hour, go home, drink,
analyze,
think about
data.
It, drink tea, by the way. Yeah. Download the data in your head. It's exactly the same thing. You can make it as simple as a learner driver learning. You know, think about what you're doing, think about where the improvement could be made, and then you'll automatically make it when you get out on the track next time. And riders will be looking at themselves as well, inwardly, as well as all the technical stuff that the teams will be doing. The riders will be looking at themselves, now where can I improve? And they'll be going out over every race, every corner, every breaking point. It's a wonderful exercise. I interviewed Valentino Rossi on stage at Silverstone. Seems like a hell of a long time ago now. But, and I said to him, do you do the same work as all the kids? Do you still look at all the data? Do you still watch all the videos? And he looked at me like I was stupid, because of course I was stupid, because of course he does do that. That's what you do when you're a top line rider. Analyze everything. And that's exactly what even Valentino at 40 years old, 41 years old as he was when I was interviewing him, he still looks over every single thing on the PlayStation, looking if there's anything even in a PlayStation game that might be of use to try and find an advantage. Mm. That's what it's all about, mechanically and physically.
Well, the crucial question from that, of course, is how does your daughter take that?
She didn't have a choice. Team manager.
No more lessons otherwise.
I think she's off to find another team.
There's some manager deals going on. Well, Mir is currently in fourth, 1 point ahead of Miller and 8 behind Bagnaia in a Ducati sandwich, which sort of brings us nicely on to Ducati. Let's talk about actually Pramac Zarco, fastest independent. But it was an overall struggle, I think he said for him. You know, the win was never really in sight. Zarco knew it would be a difficult race, but crucial points for him in a championship challenge. But do you think it's slightly fading?
Well, let's have a little think about that first of all. Bagnaia got a bloody ride through. Otherwise, yep, he'd have been right there on a Ducati. He had a ride through for exceeding track limits. I'm sure we'll get to the track limits.
Don't you worry.
I've had enough of that now. Jack Miller basically fell down and damaged the bike and got a black and orange flag in the end. So that took him out of it as well. So I think Ducati were a little bit unlucky. It's not really a Ducati track, is it? Perhaps, unless the weather had turned slightly, which is where my betting was going.
Yes, who was your prediction again? It was, yes, you were Miller, weren't you? Yeah, oh no. Miller. Poor day for Miller. And actually, Pete... Pete was Oliver. I'm just happy because I finally got a point on the board.
Yeah, I can.
But no, I think you're right there.
I tell you what, I can't believe the two of us had first choice over Harry and we let him have Quartararo.
It's all even now going into the summer break. It's perfect. But you're right. You know, Ducati did show pace, particularly with Bagnaia. We had a great scrap for the lead as well. Paid the ultimate price for track limits with a long lap penalty. But he really, if he hadn't have had that, it would have been a real proper battle, do you think, with Quartararo to the very end?
No.
Oh, okay.
I think Quartararo had pace. I think Quartararo was riding a very smart race. He was on a motorbike that worked for him around there, and I couldn't see him being beaten, to be honest, in the end.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that stood out for me for the Ducati was the ride height device. You know, you saw for lap after lap with Bagnaia, Marquez and Aleix, and Aleix spoke about it. He said, we were faster than him, but we just couldn't get by him. As soon as he, you know, the back of that bike dropped down out of the last chicane, it just rocketed away. And bear in mind, they've also got the ride height device. It's not like it's against the Suzuki that doesn't have one. And yet the Ducati one just seems to work so much, you know, better than even the other bikes.
I think it's called allied with horsepower, Peter. It's maximizing the horsepower that the Ducati has. I mean, unfortunately, wheel spin is a thing that's a real thing on big old bloody MotoGP bikes. And if you can manage that, minimize the amount of wheel spin you're getting, that means that the traction isn't banging in on you. Traction control's not banging in on you. And it's driving forwards. And I think out of somewhere like the chicane where you know, you're on your side through there trying to get it to hook up and it sits down and points the thing in a... I mean, Ducati have definitely got it sorted out. But again, you know everyone else is going to be looking at that when we get back. But rear wheel grip has been a problem with the Honda, or with the Yamaha. That's something that we've been hearing quite a lot about. I was kind of surprised and not surprised that Mark ended up in seventh place. I mean, still the best Honda. I had a bit of a Takagami feeling for a while. I thought that maybe Takagami, after free practice and qualifying, might just come up with something a bit special. But in the end, the Honda challenge fell away on race day.
He looked like he was on the verge of tears as well, again.
I was just going to say, yeah, he looked really, really disappointed again, yeah. And Mark, earlier in the weekend, actually paid him quite a compliment when he said that, you know, of all the other riders with the riding style for the Honda, Taka looks like he's you know, getting quite a long way there with it, if you like, of how to ride it.
From the day he came into the LCR team, I remember Cal Crutchlow saying he can really ride a MotoGP bike. He was really impressed with him straight away. And that's, you know, Cal's a good bloke. He sort of tells you how it is. And for him to say that, you believe him straight away. There was no reason for him to say it other than the fact that that's what he'd seen, that he could see something that Tacker can ride a MotoGP bike straight away from the get-go. The bloke is certainly due, isn't he, Nakagami? A result of something special. But when it will come, I don't know. He's still going to be looking back to the likes of, where was it, Aragon?
But they weren't slating him too much, but they were saying that, you know, there was a lot of mistakes coming in from Nakagami yet again. But it felt like if they were mistakes, they were very minuscule mistakes that just unfortunately were compounded by once one gets through, then they all come through.
Well, I think a minuscule mistake is what you don't make nowadays. That's what I was saying earlier. It's a thousandth to thousandths of a second. There is no room for any these guys. They're, like I said before, they're the guys that are earning the top money. They are the top riders. They should not make mistakes. It's and he will be frustrated. The worst kind of criticism is your own. It's not about what other people say on Twitter. The worst kind of criticism as a rider is when you know you've mucked up in a certain way. It might only be a minimal amount, but you've mucked up. You've not got the best from that package. And it crucifies you. When you come back in, you don't need a crew chief or a bloody data sheet to look at to work it out. You already know. Lap on lap, you know where you made a very slight mistake here and there. And that goes back to even, you know, the year dot. Any self-respecting rider analyzes exactly what they've done or haven't done during the course of a race and tries to put that right. And at this level, Tacker obviously felt that, you know, he'd made one or two too many mistakes. It's cruel. But hey, it's what we said before. It's the big boys, and you're earning the bucks. Get on with it.
And certainly, those small mistakes, it was illustrated in practice because we were seeing lap after lap for Tacker being cancelled for track limits, which is exactly what you're saying, Keith. So it was almost like he would barely get a completed lap because it was cancelled, cancelled, cancelled. And as Keith says, you just can't make those mistakes at this level. Coming back to Mark, he was pretty happy. And bear in mind, he was 20th on the grid, wasn't he? It was his worst ever qualifying.
I'd have been happy to have survived.
After that accident, yeah. And he was saying, yeah, right-hand track, this was his best, the first time he's really been competitive on the right-hand tracks, if you like, you know, which is the bad side for his arm. He felt the bike had the pace for the podium. So he's feeling better about it, but I mean, it was another, as Keith says, another massively lucky escape with that high side on the Friday.
Scary to watch that, wasn't it? Well, go on then. When are we getting Freddie on, Keith? Because yet again, it's another weekend full of controversy, full of penalties, track limits. It's all going on yet again.
I've started writing my Freddie Spencer question list. And it starts right at the beginning. Look, I spoke with Freddie a couple of weeks ago. He was quite keen at that point. And I think that what I'll try and do is ring him again this week, if I can, and ask him when he'll join us on this good old conference call. And we'll give him some space. I mean, I know you guys will because you're very respectful. And I mean, Freddie's a hugely talented man. He's an astute, clever, analytical fellow, not to mention a bloody good rider. It wouldn't be a stitch-up job from any of us three, that's for sure, because the three of us aren't interested in that. But it will be interesting to get to the bottom of how the process works. I want to know more about the other two guys that are in there with him. You know, how much influence do they have on decisions he makes? You know, because as far as I'm concerned, they're non-entities. I'm sorry to say that, but they're just, you know, corporate bods that are in there as a committee. And as a person, I have real difficulty with committees anyway. Just because, you know, you can talk round and round in circles. What's right is right. What's reasonable is reasonable. JC, I said that I spoke to John Cooper earlier on today. Lovely bloke, John Cooper. And we talked about penalties because that's what all ex-motorbike racers talk about. And he was saying it's ruining the race and it's ridiculous, da-da-da-da-da, which I can understand. And I explained to him that the reason why, you know, penalties are such an issue nowadays, track limit penalties particularly, is because we're now measuring to a thousandth of a second, three thousandths of a second, sorry. A thousandth of a second, three decimal points. That's where we're going to. I think it should be four, personally, because we're that tight nowadays. Sometimes you'll get two or three riders to three decimal points on exactly the same time. And when you are riding, when everything is that tight, you cannot allow even a degree of advantage to anybody. You know, otherwise you're doing the sport down. Back in the day, I remember when I first started racing around Mallory Park, they measured it to a tenth of a second. A tenth of a second is from here to the other side of the village in real terms. You know, it's kind of like, tenth of a second. Well, you might as well start off with one of them bloody egg timers, you know, or wait till the sun comes round on the dial. Yeah. Honestly, it's kind of like, and the reason why these penalties are there as much as anything is fairness. It's safety, of course, but it's also fairness. When you've got a sport that's so tight, so incredibly tight, to allow someone a thousandth of a second advantage over another rider onto a straight, you've got a thousandth of a second advantage through a corner onto a straight because you've gone over you've used that extra bit of track, you are going to be two or three thousandths of a second better off by the time you get to the end of the straight. That's how it works. You know, it's how early you can tap the throttle on, how late you can get on the brakes, it's all relative. So I can understand the penalties, but where John, getting back to JC and what he said was, he said it should be that if there has been no advantage, that's when they can apply the penalty. So if you run off because you've had a nudge or whatever it might be, but you haven't gained an advantage, and I can see where he's coming from with that. That it sounds almost reasonable, but then it comes down to human error then. Freddie and his boys back in the stewards box, it's suddenly not clear cut. It's then their opinion whether it was an advantage or not. And then you've got the data from the teams that's very, very accurate, believe me. And they will be able to tell you more than anybody looking in by eyesight whether there was or wasn't an advantage. It's a minefield. I nominated Freddie when it came to, they were looking for someone to do the stewards job. And I remember making the nomination to Mike Trimby back in the day, because I know how analytical that Freddie is. And I kind of wish I hadn't, because I feel sorry for Freddie. He gets so much crap for trying to do the job as best as he can. And he's got no bias. It's not like it. And he's not stupid. Like, you know, like when you read Twitter, you'd think this guy, you know, wasn't capable of doing his job. He absolutely is. So I think, getting back to what you said, Harry, I'll speak with him this week and hopefully we can get him on for next Tuesday. But don't hold your breath just yet, because I don't know what your schedule is.
Well, we've got 5 weeks.
Or where he is.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Well, but we might as well strike while the iron's hot, and it's going to take him four of them to get over it with us.
Nice little holiday.
That's why we're finished with him.
Perfect holiday for the podcast. Well, look, let's...
And maybe too, I think, as I said, maybe Stuart Higgs would like to join in as well. You know, MSVR race director. I mean, Stuart is another one that I have huge respect for. I mean, he's ruthless when it comes to rules, because pretty much he made them. But his thinking is usually quite... Where I think BSB scores is their transparency in their rules. And the fact is that they're interpreted by one person, which gets us over this committee thing. That's why committees always seems a little later getting the written, you know, details of why that penalty was applied. And I think with Higgsy, where he scores more than anything is that he makes the, you know, he's made the decision like that. And you'd be very hard to find a decision that Higgs has made that's been wrong. In fact, I can't think of a time I've seen a rule applied by Stuart Higgs in BSB where it's been wrong. You know, borderline sometimes, and you don't quite understand it. But as soon as you speak to Stuart Higgs, and he's quite willing to justify his position and the position of the rule, you go, oh, yeah, I get that now. Yeah, all right, Stuart. You know, you back off straight away. I've never been able to get an advantage over him when it comes to rulemaking. So it'll be wonderful to have him on here as well. Perhaps he'll join us in the next week or two. He's not shy, so I'm sure he will.
He loves a bit of camera time. Well, we'll try and make sure we get something for you during this summer break. I'm sure Keith is on the case. Let's move it on, though, before we go to Moto3 and Moto2, a couple of questions that have come in just on various different topics. So just going to pick your brains on this. First one, Jeremy Bartle. We often hear how it's impossible to get bike fit by training in the gym. Why is this? I have a friend who trains professional athletes in several other sports, but they have never heard of this and can't see why it would be the case. Great podcast. Good to still hear from Keith. That's from Jeremy.
Jeremy, bike fit. When you're training, you know, you're moving the muscles in a certain way in alliance with your brain. It's a kind of, it's not just bike fit as in physical. It's how this is working with everything else. It's the whole package. When you're bike fit, you are using things in conjunction with your brain, in conjunction with reflex, in conjunction with the outside forces that you won't get in a gym. You know, you can be, your overall fitness will be like any athlete. I mean, I have to say that the MotoGP riders nowadays, you know, if I go back to the day when I was racing in MotoGP, they just laugh at me. You're talking Mick Doohan type fitness. Mick Doohan was the first animal when it came to crazy fitness, unbelievable fitness. Now they're all like it. You know, to such a point that you can make phone calls and crash into the back of Dorna van.
Oh.
Sorry, Alex. But bike fit is about you're moving muscles, reactions, reflexes, all as one, all in a natural environment to racing a motorcycle. And I think that's what's meant by bike fit. It's not that you're fitter in certain muscle areas or muscle groups particularly, because you've pretty much done that anyway. But there are certain things that you can exercise when you're on a motorcycle that you're not going to really be able to replicate that easily in a gym, for instance. You know, running, what does that do for anything? I mean, yeah, okay, aerobically, it keeps you sharp. Cycling is probably quite a good one, because you've got that kind of thigh area. When you're moving yourself from side to the side on the bike, you're putting a lot of leg action through the footrest and the like to position the bike into and out of corners and so on and so forth. There's a lot more going on when you're racing a motorbike than I think a lot of people could actually vouch for, having, if you've never done it, then you won't perhaps understand it. But it's a very physical, actually. There was a BSB here. We go, another bloody shout for BSB. I don't know why when we're on a MotoGP podcast, but anyway, there was a wonderful onboard camera that it was a helmet cam, I think it was. I can't remember who was running it. Was it one of the Honda guys? I think it was. It was on it's on Twitter anyway. You'll have to look it up for the BSB. And you sit for the first time with an onboard camera, you get a real feeling of a lap of Alton Park and how physical it is. It's brilliant. I highly recommend it. If you get an opportunity to look at it, please do. It's out there somewhere. But you can see how much effort, how much the bike's moving. You never get that with an onboard camera that's bolted to the bike, because they've always seem a little bit. But when it's bolted to your body and you can see how much this thing you're going through, just a lap on your own without having other bikes around you that's interfering with your aero, you know, when you're in a braking point, someone snitched your front, you know, your braking area and so on and so forth. So many more things that could be depicted. I think we've gone a bit too clinical with cameras. You know, you show a slow-mo of a guy that's about to hit the floor at 120 mile an hour, and he looks, oh, he just bounces a little bit, you know, the airbag pops up. You know, the Mark Marquez accident, you know. So someone at home, oh, look at that, Mark, oh, that was quite big, wasn't it? Big? It shattered every bone from my neck to my toe, than me. You know, I think that the cameras nowadays have become so bloody sterile. But this particular one was obviously a stuck on the helmet type thing. God, I remember all the hairs on, and talking about it now, all the hairs are going up on my hands now thinking about it. It's just so exciting to watch.
Well, brilliant. Well, hopefully, anyway, Jeremy, that has answered your question about how we get bike fit. One more for you before we move on to Moto3. Barry Allen, and we have talked about this before, but he's asked, do you think qualifying, for example, Q1 and Q2, should be changed to add a Q3 that is a top six shootout for pole, where they have a one lap flyer, mainly to stop all this tagging another rider, and when a rider's on a fastest lap and he gets blocked or a yellow flag comes out and he misses his fast lap? That's what Barry is. So a change to qualifying, do you think that's a feasible route to go down?
Well,
yeah.
I think everybody behind the garages is looking at how on earth they're gonna, I mean, it's translating now to MotoGP. We've started having MotoGP blokes dawdling around looking for someone to aim at, which is, you know, once it's starting to move to them as well, it's got to the point of being ridiculous. Well, it already is ridiculous, to be honest, in Moto3, and hugely dangerous. You know, I've been in a situation where other riders have tagged somebody that's travelling slowly. Unfortunately, I was in exactly that same situation 33 years ago, when my bike basically cut out on Cadwell Park Straight as we came out onto the straight, and it rolled off, which is the equivalent of a bike dawdling. And Kenny Irons was unsighted, didn't see everyone parted around me, and Kenny just gently tapped me from behind, but of course tipped him over and he lost his life. You can go to Silverstone in 1983, the Irish kid that was hit the back of Peter Huber when he was travelling Norman Brown. He was travelling slowly out of Stowe Corner when he got either a breakdown or was going to come in or whatever it was, and he got hit. And, you know, the rider behind dodged him, and Peter Huber didn't. He came through unsighted and hit him. I've seen these accidents, and they are huge when they happen. You know, we lost a kid the other day that was hit amidships. You know, Jason DePasquier. The only time you're going to get seriously injured is when you get caught up with something else, when you hit a barrier or a bike hits you or whatever it might be. They're the incidents that we've got to really cut out, and they're unnecessary. These kind of situations where you only need one rider to be unsighted and he's pulling 100 mile an hour plus, and the rider's dawdling around at 40 mile an hour, and the contact closing speed is so high, not to mention the fact that you might have someone else that might clout you when you're down. It's got to be stopped one way or another. So the question is serious, and everybody in MotoGP, Moto2, Moto3, IRTA, Dorna, the FIM, will be considering it, will be thinking about it. This five-week break, yeah, they might have a couple of extra wines going into the five-week break, but then everybody is going to be working hard on where the second half of the season goes and what changes they can make going through into 2022. And qualifying is going to have to change. I mean, we can't have Super Pole or stuff like that. I hate that kind of thing. I'm sure the fans, it takes away the spectacle of it. But there has to be some incentive. I think the teams should be penalised more, personally. I mean, normally I would say, Peter, that teams are very smart entities. People within teams, technically, politically, are very, very sharp people. But then you get a situation where dozens of riders over the year miss the final lap in their qualifying period because they haven't sent them out on time. So clearly these guys ain't that smart, and clearly these guys can't tell the time, because otherwise they would get their time in. I sit there sometimes in commentary, not so much now, but I'm on my sofa now, so it gives me even more time a little bit, and I think, what? I could get them out on time from my sofa if I rang them up. I don't understand why they still miss their last qualifying lap. And the same thing applies as why there isn't a situation where management are controlling what their riders are doing, where they put them out on track and so on and so forth. Why they're not sharing the responsibility between the two men team to make it work. Yeah, okay, if they want a slipstream, go out together. They're two team members and make it work during the session. They're very small sessions, only 15 minutes. So at the end of the day, I can see where that can be a problem. So my view would be, yes, there needs to be something else done. Sorry, it took me this long to get to it. Yes, it needs something else doing, but I would fine the team big money. I would fine the team. Riders are irresponsible by nature. They're just going to try and look for an advantage every which way. They're going to fib about what they would do. Yeah, I had a problem. Yeah. It's all rubbish. Don't trust a rider when he's trying to find the best time, because he's just going to tell you a lie. So fine the team. Make it the team's responsibility to bring their rider into line.
Okay.
See where that goes.
Barry Allen, there's your answer. We'll see. Is it possible, I suppose, within the regulations that they could suddenly change in this break how qualifying works? Is that possible? Theoretically, they change something in the middle of this break, and then come Austria, we have a new qualifying format that they want to test out.
Dorna can do anything they want. Dorna are the boss.
Don't argue with them.
But I would find it unusual that they might... And to be honest, I'm not much. I think what they can do is they can apply the penalties they already have in their book. I mean, I like the fact we've got a very thin rule book. It gives the organisers a bit more autonomy into what they can do. But it clearly isn't working. You know, the fact that a Costa can win from a pit lane start, the fact that you can have a two-lap penalty and still win. We've seen penalties given. And to be honest, it's made a difference to some riders in overall race finish. But I think once you start fining teams, who are already on a fine line regarding their finances, once you start fining teams, I think you'll find a bigger difference there. I think that You know, you almost get better exposure if you've come from pit lane from a televisual point of view, or from a commentary point of view, or from a worldwide press point of view. If you've come out of pit lane and won the race from there, you're going to get double the accolades you would have done if you cleared off in the distance from the flag, from the lights out. So I think that teams need to look a bit more inwardly. I think that the teams need penalising more than riders. I think the riders have had their penalties and it hasn't had any real effect, has it? They've sort of got over it and they're just prepared to take those penalties.
Yeah, well, I think it's difficult to disagree with you. Let's talk Moto3 race action now. Pete, let's bring you on this. It was Dennis Foggia winning ahead of Garcia and Fanati. How have you made the Moto3 action up until this point in the season? Foggia under pressure throughout, but able to respond well.
Yeah, he's really on form, isn't he, now? You know, of course, the big news coming into the race was Acosta's injury, if you like, in qualifying, which links in a bit with what we're saying there about the whole qualifying system, because it was this messy accident coming onto the main straight. And I think some of the riders had even taken the checkered flag. So, but it was all caused by people leaving at the same time from the pits. And, you know, and this all links into causing these dangerous situations that, that Keith mentioned. So anyway, luckily, having been declared unfit for qualifying, he was back for the race. So that was great news for him. And you know, he did a great job in salvaging decent points, and he's got a great big lead. But yeah, Foggia is really, you know, he's hitting form now. And if he can carry this on, he's got a big task ahead to catch Acosta, but he's the man of the moment.
My favourite big hit of the weekend was Fanati again. Him and his teammate having a bundle in pit in their pit box. I'll tell you what, I know I shouldn't, and I know I'm going to get trolled for this, but I love Fanati. He's so spiky. Honestly, I don't know what happened in the pit box. Nobody does, but they both got penalties. So obviously they were both equally. But obviously Fernandez, his teammate, got up his nose, and Fanati, he's not a kid that you really got to, you know, if his ire is up, you're going to cop one, that's for sure. So Fanati finishing on the podium after having a punch up and a penalty. He got two laps, two long lap penalties, and still finished third on the podium, which kind of underlines what we're saying.
I was
going
to say, do you call that impressive, or do you go, there's a problem?
Why he got his two long laps.
Well, it is Moto3 Acosta, who leads with 158 points to Sergio Garcia 110. That's a 48 point gap between first and second, so it's going to be a lot to overcome. John McPhee going into the summer break with a solid result in sixth there. That takes some heart from that going into the summer break, where he can hopefully sort of get a run on things into the second half. Keith, you're already shaking your head. What have I said?
Well, no, it's not what you said. I just feel for John. I mean, some of it's been his fault, some of it hasn't been his fault, but we're in round nine and he's only scored in four rounds. You know, that's the bottom line of it. You don't win world championships when you don't score points in five of the nine races you've been in, for whatever reason. It's a very frustrating time for John, and difficult to see what's going to happen to him at the end of the year with the way it is. He's going to have to start winning some races. You know, he's in a very, very difficult... He'll know it better than anybody. He won't need any of us to remind him of it, but we are anyway. But 13th place in the championship, 37 points, compared with the 158, like you've said, of Acosta at the top. You know, that's irretrievable. All he can do now is go. And again, we are going to have a short second half of the year. I feel fairly sure of that. We've got Texas that's now on, that's coming to join us after Japan has dropped out. But Thailand is still tight, as in COVID-wise. I mean, they're getting jabbed over there now. I'm reliably informed. Australia, Sydney's just been shut down for another 2 weeks as of today. I can see the Australian round going again. Now, in the state of Victoria, it's like a nanny state down there anyway, so you can be fairly sure that they're not going to let us oiks in. I'm fairly sure that that's going to be shut down. Malaysia, maybe, because it's Petronas and Sepang International. Maybe they'll find a way around that there, because you can do those kind of things in that situation. Don't know. I just think that we're going to be at least a couple of rounds shorter than we've scheduled this year. Unless they go for a double at Texas, you know, they could do that, I suppose. Keep them out in America for an extra one to make that work. Silverstone, looking forward to Silverstone. Don't quite know what form it will be in, but I'm looking forward to it nonetheless. It's going to feel like a breath of fresh air if we can get down there.
Well, yeah.
But no, it's a tricky one. McPhee, Having said that, that sixth place that he got at the weekend bumped him up three places. He was 16th in the championship. He's now 13th in the championship. So, yes, it is positive. So, therefore, let's stick with the positive for him for the minute. For me. Yeah.
And just coming back on that, actually, sorry for Pete for cutting you out there. You go, please. You've got more important things to say than I have.
No, I was just going to say, and on the other side of the garage, of course, you know, the team, they never seem to have just a clean race for both riders, do they? I mean, we saw three-place penalty for Darren Binder, who, speaking about next year, it sounds like he has a chance of going up to Moto2 next year. So, you know, there's a lot going on there. But clearly he was fuming. I think he said something with beginning with F, didn't he, after the race?
Fiddlesticks.
Something begins with an F and one that ends with an F.
Actually, Pete, it's like you're reading my mind because we've had a question in from Tiva, which is what I wanted to go on to. Why did Darren Binder have to drop three places instead of one? Simple question there from Tiva. But is there a simple answer?
Why they didn't make their mind up in the first place was a funny bit. First of all, you got one place, and then the thing went across the bottom of the screen, two places. Then it went across the bottom of the screen, three places. And you could see Binder slowly but surely, it was rising. He was getting redder and redder. And then he let a load of Fs go.
So is there an answer to that question?
I think he exceeded track limits. I think it was twice. Certainly more than once. I think it was twice. But as you could see from his reaction, the second one was very hard to see visually, shall we put it. But as Keith explained, there's sensors in the curbs. So that's why these things can be triggered even when it looks like they haven't done anything. But it's the problem that we keep coming back with penalties is no one likes races or position changes after the checkered flag. I mean, they're bad enough during the race, but when you get people changing position afterwards. But on the last lap, we've seen this is what happens, and it's the latest example of track limits on the last lap.
Well, it can get worse than that. You can finish your race, you know, having been penalised already by going off at turn 12 at Sachsenring, and then find that you've got a penalty going into this round at Aston, a la Jake Dixon. You know, what was all that about? I mean, from where I'm stood and all the cameras I see, that just looked to me like a 50-50 racing incident. We're arriving at turn 12, which is a tricky old corner anyway, dropping down the hill from Sachsenring. But, you know, Dixon was already penalised by the fact he'd gone across the gravel. He finished, you know, he was a stone last when he rejoined the race. So then they give him another penalty coming into this one, which wrecks the Petronas team's, you know, momentum going into Assen, which I know Dixon would have been really looking forward to because it's a track he knows. Don't know. Freddie, we're ready for you. If we can get you next week,
we really are. Okay, last one on Moto3 before we move up to Moto2 then. So is it Acosta's to lose now? We are into the summer break. Acosta seems like he can pretty much get a solid result no matter what's thrown at him. Keith, let's come to you. And then Pete, who's going to win this championship?
Well, Acosta at the moment, I mean, he's been brilliant, hasn't he? Anyway, I mean, his track craft has been brilliant. He's had the wins. It's not just that he's had the wins, it's the way he's won quite often, the way he's come through towards the end of a race. But, I mean, that picture of him in the hospital bed the night before, eating a burger, he's my man, I've got to say. he might be only 16 or whatever he is now. He's 16 still, I think. And he's there. He's had the biggest clattering. I mean, he's had a bike run over his chest. He's had to go to hospital, missed the bloody session that he was looking forward to anyway, and then they've kept him in overnight. And I can't remember which journo said it now. It might have been Hodgie actually on BT Sport, and said something along the lines of, "Yeah, they don't keep you in hospital just for the bed space. You know, you're there for a very distinct reason. Like observation is not because they like the look of you; it's because they're worried about you." So the fact that he was in hospital under observation. And then he let him out to race and he finished fourth, which was magnificent. But I still think that picture of him with all the electronic devices on him and the burger in his hand, brilliant.
it's a cost to lose. I mean, everything Keith has said. For me also, it's not just the races that he's won that have been impressive. It's when he hasn't been on race winning form, you know, that he's able to keep his head, not overdo it, which is... seems to be a rookie thing quite often that, you know, they get that panic on of why aren't I going as quick as the other guys, and then they fall off. He's been able to keep that under control, and, you know, it's hard to see him throwing it away now, let's be honest.
I think it's very difficult, isn't it, to disagree with that. Okay, let's move on then to Moto2 at the end of all that. Raul Fernandez wins ahead of Remy Gardner and Augusto Fernandez. Fernandez really had to sort of fight hard for that victory. Brilliant move on Sam Lowes and the other Fernandez as well. Just sort of really showing, considering his experience compared to his teammate of Gardner, he's very precise with that bike, isn't he? And he's sort of showing more and more what he's capable of, and a great bounce back after sort of crashing out last weekend as well.
I think he showed us two things. Showed us how good he is, but we already knew that. And what a good year that Aki Ayo's team's having. But it also, for me, showed how mature Remy Gardner was. He wasn't going to push it. Just that, you know, Remy Gardner of old would have slung it at the fence rather than seeing his teammate be in front of him, is my opinion. But Remy Gardner this time just had to give best this week. He won't be next time, that's for sure. But with a 31-point lead Gardner has over Fernandez, the Ayo team... Well, I don't know what the phrase is. They're having it off at the moment, aren't they? It's looking really, really good.
Exactly. It was just a further sign of why, even though Fernandez keeps saying, I'm 99% Moto2, was his words, wasn't it? People are linking...
I had 90 written down.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe it changes, you know, depending on the session. Yeah. But yeah, you know, you could see why. I mean, if he carries on at this rate, you would almost say... I mean, he's won, what, three races now, I think? If he keeps on going like this... Why spend another year in Moto2, even if he doesn't win the title?
Ayo will have two guys going up to MotoGP, and with the Yamahas, as we've already covered right at the very beginning of this lengthy chat.
3 hours ago.
You know, Fernandez, he's going to be on everybody's shopping list, isn't he? Remy Gardner's going up to MotoGP next year. And that just goes to show you the strength. And I talked about rider managers. They don't come any better than Aki Ayo. He might own that team, but he's also a rider manager as well, manages some good names. And he's going to be manoeuvring for his boys as well. He's going to make sure that they get the best deal.
Well, Peter Warner has asked, with the current rumours of impressive riders such as Acosta and Fernandez being swiftly moved up classes, do you believe it's actually their best option, or do you think they would benefit from a second year in their respective classes?
Look, I mean, it's a question for the rider and for his personal manager. He will know where his head's at with all of this, as it is at the moment. I mean, I think that if the manager has got a deal on the table with a good team, with a top-line motorcycle, go for it, would be my view. Again, if it's Aprilia or... Actually, they're all very, very good teams now. But second riders of Aprilia have notoriously not done well. And that's the only thing I would say. A manager that gets a second rider in Aprilia or any of the other teams, if you're a second rider, you genuinely are a second rider. You're second in their thoughts. They are second in their pay. In quite often the cases, you're paying to be as a second rider. It's gone down the old car route a little bit on that one. There are a few pay rides still in the paddock. But if I was Raul Fernandez's management, the only way that I would have him going up to MotoGP is if it was with a top team, both motorcycle-wise and in their management. That's the way that I would be doing it.
Keith, if you were Raul Fernandez, as you say, or his manager, would you be slightly concerned that the factory KTM guys look like they're going to be locked in there for another couple of years? You know, is that maybe the one trump card that Yamaha have, is we've got an open seat at the factory team? You know, that's the one thing that KTM maybe can't...
Yeah, you've got a lot of teammates in KTM, haven't you? A lot of good teammates in KTM that could just, if you have a slight dip in your performance, someone can slide in there really quickly. And we saw how ruthless they were with the Frenchman. When Zarco quite politely said, look, at the end of the year, it's not working for me, so I think I'll try and get out of this if I can at the end of the year. And the effective was from the Austrians, well, why wait till the end of the year? Off you go. So it was kind of... It's come back down to the fact it's business and it's ruthless and it's hard and it's gritty and you've got to get on with it. I would say that Raul Fernandez, if given the right ride, should go. And I think that's just one more reason, Peter, that you've just put up there as to why you should go, is that take your opportunity if it's the right opportunity at the time. But conversely, he's going to be looking across and he's going to be thinking, yeah, Maverick Vinales did that. Stepped away from Suzuki and went to Yamaha, which looked like the best deal in the world at the time. And it didn't work out for him. Suzuki, again, from a team perspective, seems to be a calmer team, a more gentle team. Although, having lost Brivio, it might not be now. Things might have changed at Suzuki. These things are fluid, aren't they? Every year, you know, stuff changes. But yes, is the answer. I would move.
Fair enough. But it is Remy Gardner.
I didn't like talking.
It is Remy Gardner with a 31-point lead from Fernandez. Bezzecchi third. Sam Lowe's also cementing fourth with a good return to form from him as well. He's going to be... What's next for Sam Lowe's? I know we've spoken about it kind of on and off a little bit, but if we just sort of focus lastly on Lowe's here in the MotoT chat, what does Lowe's need to do to try and, you know, get a MotoGP ride for next year? Is that feasible? Is it on the cards?
Not on the cards as far as I'm aware at the moment. I mean, as I said earlier, Roger Bennett, his team manager, will be working quite hard to look at what there is available, to see whether there's a position for him. But what he needs to be doing is winning races again. Fifth the round before, fourth last time out, good ride. Need to keep it on the track, really, Sam, and keep it working. Those two wins back in Qatar... seeming like a long way off. And when you're in the summer break at the moment, the fact that he's had a couple of reasonable rides leading into the summer break always helps your negotiations. You know, summer break is a busy time from a managerial point of view. And with what's happening at Yamaha, that's just been ramped up to sort of boiling point now. You know, Sam and Roger will be eyeing up what the possibilities are. But when you've got so much talent that's lined up at the minute, of a certain age as well, you know, Sam's in an equally difficult position. You know, he's a super talent on a Moto2 bike. He can ride a MotoGP bike. We know that. It's whether somebody is going to take that. I'll use the word risk, because there's always an element of risk in it. We'll see.
As you're saying, Keith, the trouble is there's so few rides up for grabs this year, as we've been saying with Vinales' situation. You know, where's he going to go? You know, and he's a nine-time MotoGP race winner, and he's got limited options. So Sam's best chance really is next year. There's a lot of contracts at the end of next year coming up for grabs. Dorna have shown that if you win the Moto2 title, they will help you get a MotoGP seat, won't they? So I think that's Sam's best chance, really. I think he's got to focus now on building up and focusing on next year, getting the title, and then that's his best route, in my opinion, back to MotoGP.
Dorna are desperate for a Brit to be in MotoGP competitively.
Well, we'll see how it all plays out. Final one then on Moto2. Is it Gardner's to win and, well, Gardner's to lose as well in Moto2? It's hard to see anyone coming back. I hate saying, you know, I want it to be unpredictable, but he's got, you know, he's just got it all going for him, isn't he?
Well, once you take the competitive side of it out of it, then you have to look at the injury side of it. And that's the one wild card that you can never get away from at this level of sport. You know, Remy is looking smoother than he's ever looked. He's looking like a proper weapon. He's faster than everyone else, pretty much, most of the time. So it's really just down to staying fit. It only takes one mistake.
Yeah, I think he's certainly, you know, if you look at Moto3, there's a much bigger risk of just losing a lot of points in a race, gaining a lot of points. You know, as we've been saying, Moto2, it's Akiyo's team. They're at the top every week in, week out. And especially when it's your teammate that's your title rival, it's harder for them to gain points on you because, you know, maybe a team has a bad race. Well, that means maybe Remy has a bad race, but also his teammate will. So you move up and down together, if you see what I mean. It's harder to make those big gains. And, you know, Remy's looking rock solid at the moment. It's going to be interesting, though, I think, to see as Fernandez builds, you know, this kind of the situation between them. I think it could be quite fascinating, but undoubtedly Remy is the favourite.
Absolutely. Again, another one to disagree with. Right, finally, predictions. Now, no race predictions, obviously, because we've now got a bit of a gap. But, and again, I suppose it brings up the whole, if the competitive edge is gone, then maybe it's the injury side of it. But I want your MotoGP world title predictions, please, locked in now, and you cannot change them no matter what happens in the second half of the season. Well,
all of us are going to go for Quartararo, aren't we?
I'm a newbie. This is my rookie year in MotoGP and motorcycling, so I'm going to go outside the box here because I still think all to play for, and who knows, And perhaps this might be naivety coming through, but I'm gonna go first, and I'm gonna go with Zarco.
Brave move, and I like someone that has a sporting bet. That's usually me that goes for the sporting bet.
Yeah, but if you both want to go for Quartararo, I will allow it.
I think what we should do, Harry, if I may, I mean, I don't want to spoil your game, but maybe we ought to go. Since we're going this far in advance, maybe we ought to go for a top three.
Oh, okay. That seems more sensible, actually. Yes. Okay. So you're 1, 2, 3.
Go
in
on,
which
Pete.
Case, Pete can have the honour of going first.
I will go with Quartararo. 1. 2, 2. Yeah, Zarco. I think Zarco. Yeah, he could hold second, and I'll go Bagnaia 3rd.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What you mean exactly as they are at the moment.
Exactly as it is now, yeah.
You can read a bit further down the list if you like, Pete. I get where you're coming from.
Wait, can you just repeat that for me? So that is the top three as they currently stand going into the summer break. Quartararo, Zarco, and Bagnaia. Okay. They're locked in from Pete. Keith, you can go next.
I reckon, seeing that we've got two Austrian rounds, fast old Silverstone, I'm going to go... Well, Quartararo, I think, will win it. 34-point lead at the moment. It's going to take an injury to mess that up. I'm going to go Quartararo, Bagnaia, and Mir.
Oh.
Just to be a bit different. I think Suzuki's going to come back a little bit stronger after the break. I think Bagnaia's shown real good form, but been a bit unlucky so far. I actually should go Quartararo, Bagnaia, Zarco, but again, it's that sporting bet that I can't get away from. Oh. And the world champion, I don't think we've seen the best of him yet this year.
Fair enough. I feel like I'm now being a bit of an idiot.
But the only trouble is, I kind of talked myself into something and then out of it, because like really with the two Styrian rounds, we've got two in Austria, which is going to be Ducati and KTM that are going to be flying. And you've got Silverstone, which is, you know, well, actually Suzuki and Yamaha at Silverstone have got quite good form. Aragon, again. I'll stick with what I said.
Okay, well, I'm going to stick with my Zarco. Who knows, an injury potentially. And then Quartararo second, and I'm going to put Oliveira is going to work his way up to third, I think.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I like that. Yeah. I think Oliveira definitely should be on there somewhere. So I think we've got a good mix there. So one of
we
us
have.
Is definitely going to lose.
Well, they are locked in now. So we cannot change that. So just to confirm, Pete has gone for Quartararo, Zarco and Bagnaia, the top three come the end of the year. Keith is Quartararo for champion, Bagnaia second and Mir in third. And I've gone Zarco champion, Quartararo second and Oliveira third. So we will come back to that whenever the season ends.
and if you want to get involved, I think you should throw it out there, Harry, and find out what other people
the top
think.
Three. Yeah, go on then. Well, if you want to get involved and also be a part of our locked-in predictions, send us a tweet, an Instagram, whatever works best for you. Just find us on the Crash Moto GP. Send that in. We'll collate them, and we'll make a little leaderboard come the end of the year as well, and see who gets closest to it. So I'm now feeling a bit stupid for being Zarco first, but hey, I'm going to stick with it to the very end. Once again, though, gents, I think that just about does it. After all of that, thank you for your thoughts and input. As ever, and a big thanks to you all and for our listeners and watchers. We really appreciate you commenting, leaving reviews and sending your questions in. Do send in your title predictions, please. Your 1, 2 and 3 locked in. You cannot change them until, well, next year now. We are entering the summer break, though. It's a 5-week gap now till Austria, but never fear, we will still be here every week because there is still lots to discuss and we'll be keeping you up to date with any breaking news throughout the summer. In the next few shows, we'll be talking everything you could imagine. Stewarding, safety, track limits, rider moves. I want to talk about electrification in motorbikes. I'm going to bring some Moto E chat in for you too, whether you like it or not, and a lot more. And as ever, if you've got any questions, get them into our socials and keep up to date with all the very latest MotoGP news at crash.net. And join us next time for more MotoGP talk. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.